bilateral relations to help enhance security and stability of the region. A Palestinian man succumbs to injuries he sustained during an Israeli raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound more than 2 years ago. Our people in Bahrain demonstrate in support of hundreds of inmates who are on hunger strike in protest at inhumane conditions of the country's prisons. Thank you for joining us. In today's top story, Tehran reiterates its readiness to cooperate with Riyadh in a wide array of issues, including regional security. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said both countries agreed that previous deals regarding security, commerce, and economy must be implemented. Amir Abdollahian was speaking at a joint press conference with his Saudi counterpart. Prince Faisal bin Farhan said Riyadh is looking forward to further strengthening relations on the basis of mutual respect. The Saudi foreign minister said Riyadh was willing to ensure lasting security in the region through cooperation with Tehran. He said King Salman has officially invited Iran's president to Riyadh. Prince Faisal made a visit to the Islamic Republic in June, just weeks after Tehran and Riyadh agreed to resume diplomatic relations. The two countries had severed ties in 2016 following angry protests in Iran over the execution of Shia cleric Nimr al-Nimr in the kingdom. Iran and Saudi Arabia have pledged to work for enhanced regional stability. Earlier, our correspondent Gisu Misha Ahmadi shed more light on the details of the Iranian foreign minister's visit to Saudi Arabia.
And if you want to read between the lines, there are many key issues and important messages being sent out to the world, including the fact that both countries say that they are prepared to cooperate together on regional security. And this is something that we do know is high on the agenda of the Raisi administration. He has been extending his hand to neighboring countries, and he has been promoting regional security being dealt with by regional countries rather than foreign elements. And he has been able to actually gain a lot of support by neighboring countries on this foreign policy issue that he's been trying to advocate over the past 2 years. And now we see Saudi Arabia, a key player in the region, also jumping on the bandwagon. So this is very important. And then again, Kaveh, there are basically two issues I think any pundit would be looking at in respect to finding out whether two countries have good relations. Are we looking at ties growing and expanding? And one is trade, the second is sports, and the fact that the press conference was wrapped up by the foreign ministers saying that they will be holding friendly football matches.
Political analyst Fawad Izadi says only time will tell whether Saudi Arabia can withstand pressure from the U.S. and Israel and maintain good relations with Iran.
I think the Saudi government has realized that confronting Iran is not in line with their national interest, and it's really not possible to fight Iran in that manner any longer. And Iran historically has been interested in resolving issues with Saudi Arabia. Iran and Saudi Arabia are neighbors. Neighbors should not be confronted with each other. I think as time progresses, you will see these type of exchanges. I think with the visit of Iran's president, the ties will improve. There is a question that needs to be answered, and that is whether the Saudis can withstand pressures from the United States and Israel to continue this policy of following their own interests instead of listening to the ill-advised rhetoric of the United States and Israel. Whether they can do that or not, time will tell, but I think so far so good.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin have had a phone conversation on the expansion of regional economic cooperation. That's according to an Iranian presidency official who said the two presidents reviewed the progress of economic agreements, especially in the fields of energy and transit, including the international north-south transport corridor. According to a press release by the Kremlin, the two presidents also discussed cooperation in international and regional affairs, considering Iran's full membership of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and its interest in joining the BRICS group of countries. According to the Kremlin, the two presidents reaffirmed their determination to continue boosting ties in the fields of trade, energy, transport, and environment. A Palestinian man has succumbed to injuries he sustained during an Israeli raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound more than 2 years ago. 30-year-old Hamza Abu Sneina was shot with rubber bullets fired by regime forces while performing prayers in May 2021. He sustained multiple skull fractures and lost his left eye. According to medical sources, he had been suffering from the effects of his injuries for the past months, and his health deteriorated a few weeks before his death. The new fatality came as Israel is escalating its bloody repression against Palestinians. More than 200 Palestinians have been killed across the occupied territories since the beginning of this year. Venezuela has decided to promote its diplomatic representation to the State of Palestine from a representative office to an embassy. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki hailed the historic decision, stressing that Venezuela has always stood by the Palestinian people and their cause. The ministry also said in a statement that the decision is the practical outcome of recognition of the State of Palestine by Venezuela in 2009. It added that the move proves Venezuela's unswerving support for the rights of the Palestinian people at all levels. The ministry said Venezuela's decision helps the final establishment of the State of Palestine with East Al-Quds as its capital in defiance of Israel's attempts to liquidate the cause of Palestinians. People in Bahrain have taken to the streets in solidarity with hundreds of prisoners who have been on hunger strike for about 2 weeks. The protests were held in several Bahraini towns. A similar protest was also held outside Bahrain's embassy in Berlin on Thursday. The prisoners in the notorious Jow prison say they have been deprived of adequate health care, amongst other issues. A number of hunger-striking detainees have lost consciousness as the strike drags on. The Abu Falk National Islamic Society has called on people to answer the prisoners' call for a sit-in in support of them on Friday. During the past decade, Bahrain has been ratcheting up its crackdown on the country's Shia majority that only demands more political freedom. Massive street protests first started in 2011 but were suppressed with the help of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. An Omani mediation delegation is now visiting the Yemeni capital Sana'a in line with efforts to revive the peace process in the poorest Arab nation. That's according to Mohammed Abdul Salam, the chief negotiator of Yemen's Ansarullah movement. He said the priority now is the humanitarian situation in Yemen and its disastrous repercussions in light of the blockade on the country. The Yemeni negotiator said the other party to the process should show its goodwill towards Yemen through measures to ease the situation. Abdul Salam said it's necessary to remove restrictions on airports and ports imposed by the Saudi-led coalition, which started the war on Yemen in 2015. The fighting in the country has subsided following a UN-brokered ceasefire between Ansarullah and the Saudi coalition. But that truce was expired in October. Talks are now ongoing over a new, possibly permanent, ceasefire. We were earlier joined by a correspondent in Sana'a, Yusuf Mowry, for more on the Omani delegation's trip to Yemen.
Well, a lot is being discussed with the Omani delegation, first of which is the continuation of the ceasefire agreement to ensure that there's no ballistic missiles launching from Ansar Allah into Saudi or coalition forces territory, and to also ensure that Saudi airstrikes no longer are carrying out aerial raids in Yemen. And for the most part, that has been successful in this year of the ceasefire. However, there's still artillery shelling taking place in the front lines in Hodeidah and also in the north province of Saada. And so there's a lot of tensions. You know, there's tension in the air. I'm sure that the Omani delegation is going to discuss, you know, the humanitarian file.
The United States has approved the transfer of F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine from Denmark and the Netherlands. A U.S. official said Washington has assured both countries that it will expedite the approval of transfer requests for F-16s after Ukrainian pilots are trained. The transfer of F-16s from U.S. allies to Ukraine needs Washington's approval. A coalition of 11 countries was due to start training Ukrainian pilots to fly the fighter jets this month in Denmark. U.S. officials have privately said that the F-16 fighter jets would be no game changer when they arrive, given Russia's air defense systems and its air superiority. The Belarusian president has rejected allegations that Russia is trying to push his country into joining the war in Ukraine. Alexander Lukashenko made the remarks in an online interview on Thursday. He said Belarus will never participate in the war if Ukrainians do not cross its border. The Belarusian president added that Russia has already achieved its goals in Ukraine and it's time for the two sides to sit for negotiations without preconditions. Lukashenko also issued a stern warning against invasion of his country. He said Belarus will give an immediate response to any act of aggression with everything it has, including nuclear weapons, without prior warnings. Last month, Moscow deployed tactical nuclear weapons to Belarus, a move that was denounced by Ukraine's Western backers, including the US. The Economic Community of West African States has once again threatened military action against the junta in Niger. A senior ECOWAS official says the community stands ready to intervene militarily if diplomacy fails to restore order. The official said constitutional order will be restored in Niger by all means available. The official was at a meeting of ECOWAS army chiefs in Ghana to discuss the details of a standby force tasked with potential engagement in Niger. The official said a majority of the 15 ECOWAS member states are prepared to participate in the standby force. Niger's military officers deposed President Mohamed Bazoum in late July. They have defied calls from the UN, ECOWAS and Western powers to reinstate the president. The West is now mulling sanctions against the junta. We have discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Abiyomi Azikiwi, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, joins us from Detroit. And Jonathan Ofe-Ansa, publisher at Africa Briefing, joins us from London. Welcome to you both. Abiyomi Azikiwi, first over to you. It's quite incredible when you think about it how ECOWAS is pushing, in a sense, this military action against Niger. Some are saying and deducting that this is a pressure that's being exerted by the U.S. and also by France in order for ECOWAS to somewhat do the bidding here. But it has actually deployed a task force that is on standby. Doesn't that go against the sovereignty of a nation when it's being threatened by military action?
It'll be 2 weeks on Sunday since they gave a deadline to the National Council for the Defense of the Homeland in Niger, which, by the way, now has appointed a new prime minister, a new cabinet, and governors for the various districts in Niger. I think they're still being pressured by the United States and by France to take drastic action against the government, the new government in Niamey. And I believe that the reason why they have not embarked upon a military intervention is because of the widespread opposition that has developed over the last 3 weeks to any type of military intervention in Niger, even in Nigeria itself, which would have to supply the bulk of troops in any intervention. The Senate there has rejected the idea of having a military intervention, and that Senate is controlled by the president's party, Bola Tinubu's party, the All Progressives Congress. It's also been rejected by other nation states, Burkina Faso, Guinea, Mali, Mauritania, Algeria. And also yesterday, there was a meeting of the Peace and Security Council of the African Union, which could not endorse an agreement that was put forward by ECOWAS for military intervention. So I think this is very positive that various sectors within West Africa have stood up and said this should not be another Libya, it should not be another Ukraine.
Indeed. We have had some of the countries there that our guests there from Detroit mentioned, Jonathan. For example, Burkina Faso and Mali, who have said that they are going to get into action. They're going to counter-react militarily were there to be any type of military action executed against Niger. Tell us how significant that is, especially in the context where you're looking at countries that are rejecting this, in this case in point, France's, I guess, presence in the colonial sphere when it comes to the way that it treated Niger. And as you're well aware, not only in terms of its natural resource, like uranium, but also its cooperation with the U.S. when it came to the big drone base that the U.S. has there in Niger.
Yeah, we mustn't forget that the major countries that are opposing ECOWAS' plan to use military force are those countries which are under military rule. You mentioned Burkina Faso, you mentioned Mali, you mentioned Guinea. They are all under military rule, and they are all against France, the former colonial power. I mean, Burkina Faso, you know, has expelled French troops from the country. So has Mali. And Guinea also has problems with France. So you can imagine the anti French sentiment running across all these countries. And the general feeling is that, suspicion is that the ECOWAS is being tele-guided by France and the U.S. and other Western countries to use a military force. And I'm not sure that the use of military force will yield any good result. If anything, it is going to massively destabilize, you know, the West African sub-region, right? And again, I believe that ECOWAS was too hasty in imposing ultimatums, imposing deadlines on the coupists in Niger, giving them 1 week, you know, to restore constitutional rule, to restore the ousted President Bazoum, you know, to his position.
Thank you very much. We continue talking about this for a long time. We just don't have the time. That's Abayomi Ezekiwi, editor at the Pan-African Newswire. Thank you. And Jonathan Ofeanza, publisher at Africa Briefing from London. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for the news review.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Leader Meadsmith, commanders and crew of 86th Flotilla of the Islamic Republic of Iran Navy. Recently, the 86th flotilla of the Islamic Republic of Iran's navy circumnavigated the globe, returning home to Iranian waters after 8 months, traveling more than 65,000 kilometers in oceans and high seas around the world. This remarkable feat was accomplished in almost 8 months, or to be exact, 232 days, and is a source of national pride for the Islamic Republic. On Sunday, 6th of August, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with commanders, personnel, crew members, and families of the 86th Flotilla of the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy. In this program, we discuss the leader's remarks and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei congratulated the Iranian Navy for this remarkable achievement, telling the Navy personnel, "Welcome back home, all of you." The average age of the Navy personnel who circumnavigated the globe was just 30 years. And the mean years spent in service at the Navy was 15 years. The 86th Flotilla of the Islamic Republic of Iran Navy shattered all the sailing and navigational records and was a great achievement. The motto of the crew was rather appropriately, "We can." A beautiful prototype model of the Dana destroyer placed next to the leader's seat was an indication of the significance of this great achievement and a tribute to the Iranian engineers, scientists, specialists and experts whose efforts had paid off. The prototype model of Dana destroyer with the words "Dana, we believe in ourselves" written on it certainly made headlines and attracted a lot of attention. Just like in the past, the carefully chosen verse or ayah of the Holy Quran, Ayah 14 of Surah Nahl, was very much appropriate and proper in the circumstances. God Almighty says in Ayah 14 of Surah Nahl in the Holy Quran, "And you see the ships plowing their way through the seas, so that you may seek of his bounty, and that you may be grateful." Ayatollah Khamenei addressed the audience by saying, "I would like to welcome each and every one of you, dear brothers and sisters, who have made the Iranian nation proud. God willing, you all will be successful and assisted by God." The purpose of this meeting is to express our gratitude and sincere appreciation to each and every one of you. I would like to thank the 86th Flotilla of the Navy, which carried out a great mission. It successfully circumnavigated the globe, something which has never been accomplished before in the maritime history of our country. I would also like to express my thanks to your family members. The leader added, "I would also like to thank the Honourable Commander of the Iranian Navy and the strategic headquarters that was formed in the army, that is the Zulfaqar Strategic Headquarters, which was continuously in contact with the flotilla. I inquired several times about the mission and saw that they were at all times fully informed about the mission of the flotilla. I would also like to thank the support teams, the technical teams and the like. Their support allowed this great mission to be carried out with success, all working together, and you, the crew and the members of the 86th flotilla, were able to, God willing, carry out this great operation with pride. And you certainly accomplished it. I would like to take the opportunity to remember the martyrs of the Iranian Navy, the martyrs of the frigate Peikan, who, like you, were also young, selfless men. I would also like to remember the martyrs of the Honourable Army of the Islamic Republic. We are all indebted to them and their families. My dear ones, the actions of your predecessors from the time of the important events of the Islamic Revolution, continuing up until this day, has paved the way for your success today. And you should certainly appreciate what your predecessors have done. The Army and the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, the IRGC, made many sacrifices at sea, and these sacrifices have borne fruit. You are the blossoming flowers that have grown from the green plant that they brought forth, the sweet fruit from the tree that they planted. Today we are standing at a proud point in history. It's true, the Honourable Navy Commander and the Honourable Commander of the Flotilla made some good comments and some matters were also mentioned. A more detailed description and a more thorough account of the story is needed, and it must be spoken and it must be clear. We are in a position to honour you now. We have arrived at this point because of the efforts and the sacrifices of you and your predecessors. In further remarks, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei added, "The 86th Flotilla's great accomplishment is an honour that has been carried out for the first time in our maritime history. If we put aside the humiliating years of the Pahlavi and Qajar eras, we can say that what you have done today is far more than what has been accomplished in the past. Your flotilla brought about this great honour. A group of 350 people with an experienced, skillful commander was able to travel 65,000 kilometres circumnavigating the globe. You were at sea for almost 8 months, or 232 days to be exact. These are great achievements. In the world's most renowned naval forces, there are few people who have accomplished this and are able to accomplish this. But you have. You sailed across three oceans and returned proudly to your homeland. What you accomplished was very meaningful." In further remarks, the leader said, "This great achievement shows that there is great determination, willpower and self-confidence in our military forces. These are very important matters. Three important factors being determined, making an effort by having willpower and having self-confidence. In other words, we have the mindset that we can. That's one side of the story. There's also the matter of military knowledge and the ability to design. An important component of these operations is their design. It is very important that an organization is able to design something like this through military knowledge. And yet, another dimension includes courage, perseverance, and the ability to endure hardship. We speak easily about spending 8 months at sea. However, those who have spent just 2 or 3 days at sea understand what 8 months means. Enduring these hardships is very important. Each one of these truths deserves attention. That is, one very important thing is that, for example, a military group was able to acquire the capability to design an operation of this kind. Another important thing is believing in yourself and having the confidence. Effective management that is accompanied by skill is another factor. Capable, efficient, skilled management is also very important. This is the front line of the operation. Behind the scene, the formation of strategic headquarters that I mentioned and the continuous communication between the headquarters and the flotilla was also of extreme importance. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei went on to talk about anxieties and concerns of the family members of the Navy personnel. He said, "These feelings of concern are certainly very significant. Your loved ones were at sea for 8 months. You were naturally worried. You missed them. Parents, have been patient in one way and spouses have been patient in other way. They endured this and they felt proud. When I saw the television footage of the families of the sailors when the flotilla returned to home waters, I could sense the feeling of pride in the parents and the wives and spouses. This feeling of pride is very important. It motivates both you and others to accomplish this great task. If the families had nagged and complained, if they had expressed discontent and displeasure, those who had gone would have felt regret. But thank God your families passed this test well. They were very patient, and they felt proud, and they showed this pride. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader of the Islamic Revolution said, "What you did improved the confidence of our military forces. It elevated the level of our military capabilities. It strengthened the belief that we can in people's minds. And such a mindset is a blessing in itself and is a basis for progress. The enemy also backs away when it sees this. This is how it naturally is. The next point I'd like to make is that your endeavor provided valuable experience in the field of seafaring for the Navy and for our military forces. In other words, new experiences have been gained. You crossed the Pacific Ocean, and this has never been accomplished before in our maritime history. You passed through the challenging straits and waterways, as mentioned in the report. Passing through some of these straits was a difficult task, a technical task that required skill. But you managed to accomplish it. You were able to pass through these straits and difficult waterways without any unfavorable events taking place." In further remarks, the leader said, "Encountering complications on the sea in remote areas, when you were thousands of kilometers away from home, you encountered various issues that you faced and dealt with. Another experience was your self-sufficiency in fuel, electricity, and facilities such as healthcare. That is, during this adventurous voyage, you became self-sufficient in obtaining fuel, electricity and energy, and healthcare in terms of both hygiene and treatment. You were able to perform surgical operations. This is also very valuable experiences. You were able to gain experience in communicating with your headquarters. This communication is itself was very valuable." In further remarks, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "Your accomplishment has improved Iran's international image. What I want to say is that political value of your work was no less than its military value. The fact that you were able to carry out such a large task at sea, you demonstrated Iran possesses this amount of power and this number of young people, this scientific capability and this vast amount of skill, which allowed it to accomplish such a great task. It certainly increased the international status of our country." The leader added, "The next point is that there are several lessons to be learnt from your seafaring. It has significant lessons. The first lesson is that it teaches us about God. The sea is one of the clear signs of God's existence. In the supplication of Joshani Kabir, it is written, 'O he who possesses wonders in the sea.' The sea is the center of wonders of creation. The majesty of the sea, the infiniteness of the oceans, the beauty of the various sights at sea, and the sea's fury in some places, the grace of the sea, and the amazing sea creatures, these are all divine signs. They're all signs of God. The sea is actually an exhibition of God's signs. So the first lesson of this seafaring mission is that it teaches us about God. The second lesson is a lesson about the Islamic Revolution. This seafaring shed light on the value and importance of Iran's Islamic Revolution for us and for you and for everyone who becomes aware of your story. It was the revolution that gave us this knowledge, the capability and the self-confidence to carry out such a great task. The revolution gave us the determination and the courage to carry out such a great mission. In concluding remarks, the leader wished everyone and all members of crew, commanders, and personnel of the Iranian Navy success for the future.
Food for thought.
Salam, and let us listen to a wonderful piece of advice from Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, the fourth infallible successor of Prophet of Islam, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Seek God's forgiveness and repent to him, for he accepts the repentance, pardons the evil doings, and knows well whatever you do.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى و دین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, if we don't eat healthy, we'll ruin our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be here at your service, dear listeners. In today's episode, we are talking about how eating healthy will create our Islamic lifestyle, and on the other hand, how eating unhealthy is going to ruin our Islamic lifestyle. Now, the body and the soul, the ruh, has a very intimate connection. Now, the body is this physical makeup that we have, and then, of course, the ruh is this transcendental, metaphysical, you know, aspect of our total comprehensive existence as a human being. As we had said in some previous programs, a human being is made up of various interconnected and related parts, if you will, even though they are not necessarily separate from one another. It is this whole that is made up of these different aspects, if you will. So one is the physical body, one is the carnal self, the nafs, and of course one is the ruh, the soul or the spirit. And of course, you know, as many of you know, it is the ruh and the soul and the spirit which actually gives life, and it is the soul that continues to live, and it is really the soul that is living. It is just this physical body that was created for this physical realm. Now, if we start to eat healthy, then our body will be healthy, and that will have a positive impact on our spiritual self. Because if the vessel is healthy, then whatever is, you know, within the vessel, if you will, is also going to remain healthy. But if the vessel is broken or cracked or dirty or has a hole in it, or, you know, there's some other problem with it, then whatever is contained within the vessel, again, if you will, for lack of better terminology, then that too will be harmed in our Islamic lifestyle. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about how eating unhealthy is going to ruin our Islamic lifestyle. So kind of rounding off our discussion, Islamic lifestyle that we are trying to live, it includes these different aspects, right? It's not just this spirituality that we're merely focusing on when we live an Islamic lifestyle. A lifestyle means all the different aspects of our life, right? It means the spiritual aspect. It means the physical aspect. It means the aspects of the nafs. It means the, you know, different needs that a human being has, whether they are spiritual or financial or physical or whatever you want to, you know, list. Islamic lifestyle covers all of these things. Now, if we start to eat unhealthy, and we're not even talking about things that are haram, right? Which I guess we're going to have to talk about in another program. But if we start to eat things that are unhealthy, well, a lot of diseases come about. And it's interesting that the Ahlul Bayt and the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam have spoken about this. They have said that the key to disease is the stomach, meaning what we eat is either going to keep us healthy or it's going to make us sick and it's going to bring about diseases. Now, if we eat unhealthy, then we're going to start to get diseases. After we get diseases, we're going to become weak, you know, and we become weak, then of course we won't be able to live an Islamic lifestyle. We have to be healthy to live a Islamic lifestyle. Now, that doesn't mean that if somebody is sick, they can't live a Islamic lifestyle. But what it does mean is that when somebody is sick and diseased, it makes it much more difficult to live a Islamic lifestyle. Why bring about such difficulty in our life? Is our life not difficult as it is? So, if we start to eat unhealthy, this will ruin our Islamic lifestyle. But with the grace of Allah, if we start to eat healthy, inshallah, we will be able to live a pure Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Cuba.
Part 3.
The blue sky, the vastness of the ocean, and stretches of sandy beaches. Everything is ready for a luxurious vacation. The Caribbean has always been a favorite vacation spot for white holidaymakers with pockets of dollars. And Cuba has always been at the heart of this paradise. The beauty and pleasant weather of this land that is now known as Cuba was the first thing that attracted Christopher Columbus when he first set foot on the island. During the 1950s, Cuba was still attractive for North American businessmen, and the beaches of this Latin American country was a vacation spot for the occupants of Wall Street's high-rises. Apart from holidaymakers, Cuba is a paradise for another group of people as well, for organized crime and mafia groups. In those years, all sorts of criminal businesses existed in Cuba. Drugs, prostitution, gambling, and every other criminal business that was. This was the reality of Cuba in the 50s. In the years that followed, the people of Cuba chose a different destiny for themselves. After serving as Cuba's president from 1940 to 1944, General Fulgencio Batista went to the U.S. state of Florida and started a new life there. But he closely followed Cuba's political development and returned to the country in 1952 to become a candidate in the presidential election. But things did not turn out as he had expected. He did not have the popularity he thought had among the Cubans, and his rivals did not empty the arena in his favor. Batista chose a completely different path to reach power and office this time compared to his previous term. It seemed that living in the U.S. completely changed his concepts about politics. His new approach consisted of two issues. One was paying attention to Cuba's elite, who did not previously admit Batista in their closed circles. And the other one was an endeavor to create his own personal empire of wealth and power. After the 1952 coup, Cuba became a playground for American criminals and mafia groups. And Batista served as a bodyguard so that no one would interfere with their business. This was such an extent that in 1959, 40% of Cuba's sugarcane plantations all of the husbandry, 90% of mines, 80% of water and electricity, all of the country's oil industry, and two-thirds of Cuba's imports were owned by American companies. Add to that 50% of the country's railroads and 25% of bank resources, a great portion of Cuba's telecommunications that was under the control of ITT Company. American ambassador to Cuba at the time said that the second most influential figure in Cuba after the president was the American ambassador. With the public discontent, Batista resorted to the violent crackdown of any protest. His rivals claimed that during his administration, 20,000 people were executed. Fidel was one of seven children from a wealthy family. His father had immigrated to Cuba from Spain, and in a few years he had become one of the major owners of sugarcane plantations. In 1945, Fidel entered Havana University to become a lawyer. When he witnessed the political situation of the time, the violent crowd of student protests, and the miserable state of the people, he vowed to fight against the regime of the time. After his arrest, Castro was condemned to 15 years in prison on the 16th of October 1953. But less than 2 years later, on the 25th of May 1955, Fidel and his brother were exiled to Mexico after they were released by the general pardon of political offenders. A group of 82 guerrilla fighters led by Fidel Castro sailed from Mexico to Cuba on a small boat. But the operation had been leaked, and Batista's men were awaiting their arrival on the shores of Cuba. Only 21 men managed to camouflage themselves and reach the mountains and jungles. Some of the world's most renowned journalists at the time reported the story so that the people of the world would know about the aim of Castro's armed struggle.
Commander Castro, why are you leading a revolution?
I am leading a revolution because the legal government of my country was overthrown by the army led by Batista.
In the early days of 1959, Batista's men were getting ready to take control of the regions occupied by the July the 26th movement. But they were stopped by Fidel's forces. Finally, on the 8th of January, Fidel and his comrades entered Havana after days of heavy clashes. In a short time, Cuba signed economic and industrial contracts with different countries, including the Soviet Union. Only one of them was the annual export of 1 million tons of sugar to the Soviet Union. At that time, the production of one-third of Cuba's sugar was under the control of American companies. Eisenhower threatened that he will stop the import of sugar from Cuba. The sugar industry was vital for Cuba with a great influence on its economy. 1 month later, Eisenhower prohibited the import of sugar from Cuba.
At his White House preference, President Eisenhower announces that Cuba's assigned share of the United States sugar market has been cut by 95% in reply to what I call Fidel Castro's deliberate policy of hostility.
To retaliate, Fidel Castro nationalized all American companies in Cuba. Shortly after, in October of 1960, the U.S. government imposed large-scale sanctions on trade with Cuba, which continued for a few decades. These economic disputes and hostilities can be seen as the starting point between the U.S. and Cuba's new revolutionary government, because the Americans found it very difficult to leave this economic heaven behind. The interests of many U.S. companies were at stake in this new revolutionary Cuba, and this is how the conflict and economic hostilities grew day by day, and it eventually became one of the Cold War's most dangerous and crucial clashes. With the Democrats coming to the White House, there was no significant change made in the policy against Cuba. John Kennedy, who assumed office on January the 20th, 1961, consented to the overthrow of Fidel Castro, but he wanted the operations to be performed covertly and by non-Americans. Similar to what was in Guatemala 7 years prior to that against the government of Arbenz, all those who were involved in his overthrow now gathered to perform the same plot in Cuba against Castro.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
As temperatures soar, Palestinian detainees in the Zionist regime jails live in oven-like prison cells with no available means to cool off. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, the past 5 years of sweltering summers remind Yaqub Abu Asab of the Israeli regime prisons where he spent 15 years of his life. For Palestinian detainees, the hot season is itself a prison within a prison. The Zionist regime's restrictive measures compound the woes of prisoners made to suffer through yearly heat waves in prisons located in the desert or near hot, humid valleys that make life unbearable, the 51-year-old former detainee told Middle East Eye. Abu Asab spent his last sentence of 6 years in Gilboa and Megiddo prisons in northern occupied Palestine, where he says the heat waves get more severe every year. In the Israeli regime prisons, detainees regularly experience shortness of breath and general discomfort due to the absence of cooling systems and small, overcrowded prison cells, which in some prisons hold up to 8 detainees. The Zionist regime's prisons are built with concrete, which retains heat and lack proper ventilation. Meanwhile, some cells have no windows. Some are located underground, while others have single windows overlooking enclosed areas that don't let the breeze circulate. Abu Asab said, inside the cell,